Well, a very special welcome to you, whether you are a follower of Jesus or a skeptic of Jesus, or you're just unsure about what to make of who this Jesus is that we've been singing about this morning. I just want you to know that you're welcome here. We are a community of faith that believes Jesus holds the keys to life and purpose and meaning, and he leads us into those things by his Holy Spirit. And that's what we've been here to sing about, his love for us that is demonstrated on the cross, where he makes way for us to access communion with the Father, the one who made us, by paying for the penalty of our sin and drawing us into loving relationship with the one who made us. So we're delighted you're here to share that story, and maybe you come with questions. We are in a series called The Problem with Christianity. And we've been looking at the big problems that people wrestle with when it comes to faith in God and Christianity. First, we dealt with the problem of Jesus' exclusive claim to be the only way to God. And then last week, we tackled the problem between science and faith that often arises. Today, I want to wade into what I believe to be the most complex of all the problems people have with Christianity. The most complex. And that is the problem of pain and suffering. Sometimes it's called the problem of evil. We meet this in various different forms. The human experience of pain and suffering, it poses the greatest barrier for many people to belief in God, the greatest barrier. And when we look around the world and we see children who are suffering at the hands of human trafficking, or their slow death because of extreme poverty, there is something that rightly inside of us cries out, this is not right. We live in a world that experiences suffering through rape and murder and terrorism, genocide, diseases like cancer, natural disasters like hurricanes and tsunamis that will kill, wipe out entire villages of people, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in a single swoop. And in the face of all the human suffering, our hearts, they cry out, something isn't right about this. God, where are you in all of this? Do you even care? God, are you even real? And for many, they have come to see the presence of suffering as evidence that a good and loving God certainly cannot exist. The problem of pain and suffering is the most complex of all the problems people have with Christianity because it is both a problem of logic and a problem of the heart. It's both an intellectual dilemma to solve and a heart dilemma to settle within us. The complexity lies in the fact that we feel this problem as much as we think it. But to make things even more complex, this isn't just a problem that our non-Christian friends wrestle with. We, as God's people, we wrestle with this problem too, sometimes very deeply. It is a problem that many Christians wrestle with to the point where they walk away from their faith in God. We just have to be honest with that. So often, our faith is confronted and assaulted because of the suffering that we see in the world or we face in our own hearts. And we see this very wrestling in the scriptures themselves, right? We see them throughout the Bible. King David, he cried out, "My soul is in deep anguish. How long, Lord? How long?" Maybe you've prayed that prayer. Maybe you're not even a person of faith and you've prayed that prayer. Or King David says, "Awake, Lord, why do you sleep? Rouse yourself. Do not reject us forever. Why do you hide your face and forget our misery and oppression?" Or we might note the prophet Habakkuk, who said, "How long, Lord, must I call out for help, but you do not listen, or cry out to you violence, but you do not save?" Or we could look at the words of Job. Listen to some of his words. "I cry out to you, God, but you do not answer. When I hoped for good, evil came. When I looked for light, there came darkness. Days of suffering, they confront me. My lyre is tuned to mourning, and my pipe to the sound of wailing." Maybe you have felt these things before. As we enter into the problem of pain and suffering, it's important to know that the questions and the objections and the cries of anguish, they are welcomed by God. Whether you believe in God or not, they're welcomed by Him. God invites us to wrestle with Him. God does not hide from the problem of pain, so neither should we. In fact, when we wade into the problems, we are in fact joining a chorus of voices throughout history who have suffered much and cried out for answers. But get this, in the end, they have found peace both in their minds and in their hearts because they've found God and they've found answers. And not cliches, but living answers that come from the living God. And that's what I want to help you see here this morning. Here's what I want to do. This is where I want to go this morning. First, I want to look at the problem of pain and suffering from the perspective of logic, okay? In other words, can we logically reconcile belief in a good and loving God when there is so much suffering in the world? I want to look at the logical problem there. Second, I want to look at how other worldviews have responded to the problem of pain and suffering, because we all need to have an answer for the problem we face. It's a human problem. I want to look at how other world religions have tried to answer that problem. Finally, I want to highlight how the Christian faith ultimately answers the problem of pain that we have all faced at one time or in one way or another. So that's where I'm going. Three things. Okay? We good? You with me? I have a lot of ground to cover this morning, so thank you for at least staying awake thus far. Bless you. The Lord is with us. Okay, let me state clearly the problem with this problem with Christianity. That was awkward. The skeptic will likely say something like this. Maybe you're here and you're saying something like this. An all-powerful God would be able to stop evil and suffering in our world. And a good God would certainly want to do it. Therefore, because we have suffering in the world, an all-powerful and good God does not exist. Historically, this problem was made popular by a Scottish philosopher named David Hume in the 1970s. Here's how he put it back in the day. Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is impotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. We don't say that often these days. Is he both able and willing? Why then is there evil? Let me break down the logic of the problem of evil or the problem of pain and suffering for you. This is how the logic goes. Premise one, a good God would not want evil and suffering to exist because he's good. He wouldn't want it. Second premise, an all-powerful God would not allow evil and suffering to exist because he's powerful. He wouldn't let it happen. Third premise, evil and suffering do exist. Therefore, the conclusion, a good and powerful God does not exist. You track the logic here? If he was good, he wouldn't want suffering to happen. If he was powerful, he wouldn't allow it to happen. But we see suffering, therefore, a good and powerful God does not exist. I want to show you the problem with this logic. It's based on two assumptions. First, premise number one, it assumes that there is such a thing as good and evil. And we have to ask, where does the category of good and evil come from in the first place? Where do we get the idea of injustice from? Or the idea that human life in and of itself has value and should be protected from undue harm and suffering? Where does that human impulse about good and evil come from? Ravi Zacharias, he's a brilliant Christian apologist. He tells a story about a young man who stood up at the end of a talk that he gave at the University of Nottingham in England. And this young man stood up and yelled out at the end of the talk, "There is too much evil in the world. There cannot be a God." And Ravi, he addressed this student in the moment, and he said, "Yes, you're right. There is a great deal of evil in our world. But when you say there is evil, you're assuming that there is also a good." And the student agreed. He nodded in agreement. Ravi went on, "And if you say there is such a thing as good and evil, then there must be some kind of moral law to differentiate between what is good and what is evil.
And they went back and forth a little bit, but after time, the student reluctantly agreed with Rabbi Zacharias. He said, yes, there would need to be some kind of universal moral standard that differentiated between good and evil. And so Zacharias went on. Then if there is a universal moral law that governs all people at all times and in all places, then there must have been a moral law giver. There must have been someone who implanted that sense of a moral law that exists in all times, in all places, and in all people. But the problem is, that's the very one you're trying to disprove in the first place. He said, if there is no moral law giver, then there is no moral law. If there is no moral law, then there is no good. If there is no good, there is no evil. So what was your question again? And the point that Zacharias was making is that we know intuitively that there is a moral order of right and wrong in our universe, and that moral order must have got there somehow. It must have been given to us by something or someone outside of the universe. Evolution cannot answer this question, why there is a universal moral good. But God, on the other hand, God is the best explanation for the presence of good in our world, for our understanding of what is right and what is wrong. And this whole premise, this whole argument is based on the assumption that there is such a thing as good, and it's good for everyone. So it turns out that the mere knowledge of good and evil is actually an argument for the existence of God, not an argument against it. And this is precisely the logic that led C.S. Lewis. Many of you have heard that name, C.S. Lewis. He is one of the clearest thinkers of our modern time. It was this logic that led him to move from his faith in atheism to a faith in the Christian God that is Jesus. The point is that logically, the fact that there are moral categories like good and evil, because they exist, it actually moves us toward belief in God, not away from it. But let me point out another assumption. This one's perhaps a little easier to see. Another assumption at work in the problem of pain and suffering as it's presented here. The logic, it assumes that there is absolutely no good reason. It assumes there is no good reason for God to allow pain or suffering in the world. The problem of pain here assumes that there is no good reason for God to allow pain to take place. So if we were to write the assumption into our equation, it would maybe go somewhere in premise four. I'm going to put it in premise four. So it says a good God would not want evil or suffering to exist. An all-powerful God would not allow evil and suffering to exist. Evil and suffering do exist. But also, there is no good reason for that pain and suffering to exist, right? It is a presupposition. It's implied. It needs to be true in order for the conclusion to be correct. So let's test the logic of premise number four, that there is no good reason for pain and suffering to exist. Let's test the logic. But we're going to test it not from God's perspective. Can we agree on that? Because we don't have God's perspective. So let's just look at it from our human experience. Is there ever a good reason for pain and suffering to exist from our perspective? Of course there is. There's lots. Let me give a few. I remember taking my 2-year-old daughter, and remember, I'm speaking from my perspective, not from God's. I remember taking my 2-year-old daughter to get her immunizations, and it was traumatic. It was traumatic. She was old enough to remember her previous immunizations, that they were painful. And as we went into the doctor's office, she was panicked. She began to cry and to writhe because she was afraid of the pain that was about to happen. And as a father, I had to go through the gut-wrenching moment of holding my daughter still. She trusted me, and I held her still so that the doctor could administer this needle and inflict pain upon her. And there was part of me that wanted to spare her. Like, honestly, I wanted to run out of the doctor's office. As I was waiting in the waiting room and I saw her getting agitated, I was ready to bolt. But I knew that I'd get in trouble with Gina if I did that, because then she would need to go and do it, and that was not the right answer. But I knew that this moment of pain could in fact spare her something from the future, a future of suffering with the measles or something worse that could could really harm her or take her life. I was willing to expose my daughter to pain because there was a greater good beyond it. It's my perspective. Here's another example. A few weeks back, I'm going to pick on my poor daughter, Sophia, again, she's 9 years old now. When we were leaving the house in the morning to go to school, we said about 5 times, Sophia, make sure you remember to bring your dance shoes, because she was going to dance right after school. Bring your dance shoes, Sophia. Of course, Dad, yes, stop reminding me. Well, she forgot her dance shoes. And we were driving down the hill I was dropping her off at school, and she, this moment of panic, like, Dad, I have forgotten my dance shoes. And for my daughter, this is actually a serious life crisis, right? You know what it's like to be a 9-year-old and you have a social world that you need to fit into, and if you don't have your dance shoes, you're not going to fit into this social world. And so for her, there was a panic that set in that was very real to her, and she said, Dad, I need you to go back and get the shoes. And I thought for a moment, and I decided in that moment, you know what? No, I'm not going to go back. A, I don't have the time. But B, I'm okay with you to live in the pain of your situation for a moment, because I think there's something there for you to learn. I thought it was okay as a parent to let her feel the consequences of her actions. To her, it caused distress thinking that she wouldn't have her shoes, but I saw a greater good that she might learn in her suffering. Again, this is just my human perspective. This is not God's, necessarily. Or parents, what about this? We often subject our kids to a form of pain and suffering, don't we? We take their toys away or we limit their freedoms because they've done something wrong, right? Parents, have you ever tried to tell your child that they can't have their time on the iPad? It is like I am torturing my son. Like there are squealing. It's almost like I've got a rack and I'm cranking the rack and he's being pulled. Like the sounds that come out of that child when he knows that that's taken away from him. I may be exaggerating a bit. We limit the freedoms of our kids sometimes when they do something wrong. When they do something wrong like hurting another child or lying or something like that. And why do we do this? Why do we limit their freedoms? Why do we take their toys away, et cetera, et cetera? Well, ultimately, it's because we care more about their character than about their happiness. We are concerned for the character of our children, and because of which we are willing to allow them to feel a kind of pain, a kind of suffering that is very real to them, because we care more about them becoming people who are kind and honest. We want them to learn something. That's my perspective. Now, I'm saying all this simply to kind of talk about premise number 4. I want to test the premise. Is it true that there are never any good reasons to allow suffering? And it seems to me that there are. From my vantage point, there are reasons to allow suffering. But let me give you one more example. There are many people who point to the adversity that they face in life as the reason for their future success. Malcolm Gladwell makes this case in his book, David and Goliath, where he notes that research shows that 1/3 of the world's most successful entrepreneurs, at one time in their life, they battled dyslexia, or actually for their whole life, battled dyslexia. The most successful, 1/3 of them, of these entrepreneurs, battled dyslexia. And Gladwell asks the question, it's profound. He says, could it be that their success is not in spite of their challenges, but rather because of them? Could it be that they have learned something in their struggle that ended up becoming an enormous advantage to them in the future? It's an interesting question. And as I've reflected on it, I've thought about this. The truth of the matter is that for many people who have faced suffering of all kinds, they often come out on the other side stronger than they were before. Do you want proof? It's in this room. It's all over this room. If you were to ask the myriad of Christian people who have suffered a loss of a loved one or have battled a disease, or for those, if we were to ask in other parts of the world who have experienced a profound physical persecution for their faith in Jesus, many of them would respond by saying something like this. They would say, you know what? I do not wish my suffering on anyone else because it's deep. But this suffering, the suffering has thrust me into a deeper dependence and trust in a God that I did not know before. The truth is that many people, many of you in this room, you point to those moments of pain and struggle as the soil in which your deep and intimate faith in Christ has grown. Now, I say all of this to make two simple points. First, our limited human experience tells us that there is indeed some good reason for allowing pain and suffering. There are good reasons. We can see them. Therefore, premise four is proven false, and the whole logic of this problem, it falls apart. The presence of pain and suffering does not disprove God. It cannot. It doesn't make sense. And second, it stands to reason for me that if we, from our limited human perspective, can see that there are indeed good reasons for the existence of pain and suffering, then perhaps God, who has an unlimited perspective, he might know a greater good that stands behind the suffering that human beings face. It has to be a possibility, logically. When we really think about it, the problem of pain and suffering isn't really a problem of logic. It's not based in reason. Rather, the real problem lies in how we feel when faced with pain and suffering. And Blaise Pascal, he captures it when he says this: the heart has its reasons, which reason doesn't know. The heart has its reasons, which reason doesn't know. Sometimes we think it's an intellectual problem, but really it's not. It's a heart problem, and that's the point. The real problem being addressed here isn't one of logic, but one of the heart. And so before I get to that, before briefly sharing with you how Christianity deals with the heart matter of pain and suffering, I want to quickly point out how other worldviews respond to this problem. I want to point out how these other worldviews respond to this problem, because simply removing God from the equation doesn't actually make facing the reality of suffering any easier. Skeptics need to have an answer to the problem of pain as much as Christian people do. We all need an answer to this. So how do other worldviews respond to the problem of pain? We okay? You still with me? Do we need a stretch break or something like that? Maybe do some lunges here. Yeah, that's good. How do other worldviews respond to the problem of pain? Well, let's look first at Hinduism. Hinduism, it teaches that evil and suffering are the result of karma. You're probably familiar with the term karma. It's this invisible source of justice that brings good things to good people and bad things to bad people. And we hear it in our context. We hear the sentiment all the time, right? We hear the term, what goes around comes around. That's a statement of worldview karma. Or we might say, good things happen to good people. It's a worldview of karma. But ultimately, when we think about karma, when we think it through, karma justifies the suffering in our world. It suggests that those who suffer most do so because they have been bad and they must be punished in order to be purified. This is logically where the idea of karma takes us. It's in a bad place. Mark Clark, in the book that Brendan showed you this morning, he tells a story about traveling to India where he saw an impoverished woman holding her baby, and the baby was malnourished and close to death. And she began knocking at the door of his car asking for help. And so Mark reached into his pocket and pulled out some money to give to the woman, but the driver stopped him and said, "No, don't do that. You can't give them money. If you stop karma from doing its job, this woman and her baby will have to live the suffering again in the next life." See, in effect, Hinduism and karma teaches that suffering is deserved. You deserve it. Because bad things come to bad people. Buddhism or the pantheistic religions teach something different. They say that suffering is an illusion, that suffering isn't real. It is a byproduct of someone who is trapped in their physical body, their mind, and their emotions. And when nirvana is reached, the self is finally freed from these negative effects of body, mind, and emotion. And then the illusion is unmasked. Buddhism teaches that suffering isn't really real at all. It's an illusion that we must escape from by finding that inner peace. Atheism, it teaches that the suffering in our world is actually neutral. There's neither good nor bad to it. It's just neutral. It just is what it is. And it's a random force in the world. Let me let Richard Dawkins make his own point. He says this. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. It's atheism. Believes that that suffering is natural and random. And then there's secularism. And secularism is probably the most predominant thinking in our culture today. That and Buddhism, I would say. But secularism thinks that suffering is meaningless. Because secularism believes that we are made, the ultimate purpose for which we are made is to find our personal happiness. And as such, suffering is pointless because it's the antithesis of happiness. It stands in the way of our ultimate meaning, which is to be happy. And so here we have it, the worldviews, how they address suffering. Of all the views on offer today, Christianity, I submit to you, Christianity offers the most compelling and helpful response to the problem of suffering and pain in our world, far greater than any of these. Unlike karma that teaches suffering is deserved, Christianity teaches that suffering is often unfair. Unlike Buddhism that teaches that suffering is an illusion, Christianity teaches that the suffering that you face is a real problem and a problem that needs a solution. Unlike atheism that says suffering is neutral and random, Christianity teaches that suffering was not part of the universe's design in the first place, and it's not beyond God's reach to one day fully overcome. And unlike secularism that says suffering is meaningless, Christianity teaches that there can indeed be meaning in the suffering that we experience. Jesus, he offers us a compelling and hopeful view of what is really real. We need to consider Jesus. Maybe you have been living your life deflecting anything to do with Christianity away from your heart because you don't want to be known as one of those people. Look at Jesus. He offers the most compelling and real and lived hope that we can have in the suffering that we face in our world. Just consider him. Okay. If you've been tracking with me so far, I've tried to show that the problem of pain isn't rooted in logic, but rather it's a heart problem. When we see and experience suffering, the problem really rests in our heart, not in our logic. I want to close now by highlighting how Christianity deals with that hard problem of suffering that we all face. We all face it. And others in other parts of the world, they face it in even greater degrees than we do. But here's how Christianity and Jesus respond to the suffering we face. First, God feels suffering with us. Did you know that? He feels what you feel when you see pain and suffering in the world. He feels what you feel when you experience pain and suffering in your life. And we see it from the very beginning of the story in Genesis. God looks over the suffering that people experienced in the wake of rejecting his goodness and his leadership. And seeing the hatred that had spilled into the world, the greed, the destruction that came upon the earth, we are told in Genesis 6:6 how God responds. We're told, God's heart was deeply troubled. God looked upon the pain and suffering in the world, and he didn't say, oh, well, that's just the way it goes. His heart was deeply troubled. He was moved. My favorite example of this is in Luke chapter 7, my favorite example by far. In Luke chapter 7, Jesus, who is the Son of God, God in human flesh, He stumbles upon a scene of great suffering. It is a funeral of a son of a widow. So let's get the scene. This widow has lost her husband at some point in her life, if that's not hard enough, in a culture where if you lose your husband, your future is uncertain. That's not how it works today, but it's how it worked then. She had lost her husband previously, but thankfully she would have a son to look after her. But the son had died. And so this is the widow's only son. Her life was totally hanging in the balance. Not only was she facing the suffering of losing two of probably the most important people in her life, her future hung in the balance. And Jesus comes across the scene at the funeral, and I want you to hear how he responded. As he stumbles on the scene and he sees what's happening, the scriptures tell us, and this is what they say. They say, when the Lord saw, his heart went out to her. Now, when we first hear this, we think, oh, okay, that's not all that impressive. His heart went out to her. That's, a little weak, if you ask me. The translation of the Greek word here is too weak. It's far too weak. The Greek word that is used here to describe Jesus' response to pain is the word splegnizomai. I've shared it with you before. I like saying it, splegnizomai. Normally, I spit when I say it. Quite literally, this word means to be moved to the gut. There are some instances where this word is used to speak about someone's innards falling out of them. It's a visceral reaction. Have you ever come across a scene of such pain and sorrow, or experienced such pain and sorrow, that you feel it in your gut? Feel like your insides are spilling out. That's how the living God responds to the pain and suffering. He feels it. He feels what you feel. But there's more. God doesn't just feel our suffering. He steps into our human suffering in the person of Jesus. He doesn't just feel it. He enters it. Jesus, the Son of God, became God in human flesh. And having stepped into suffering, he knows what we face. The prophet Isaiah spoke about Jesus' experience of human suffering long ago. This is from Isaiah 53, verses 3 and 4. Isaiah writes, "He," speaking of Jesus, "he was despised and rejected by mankind. He was a man of suffering. He was familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hid their faces, he was despised, and we held him in low esteem. Surely, he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him, and afflicted." Let's not let these words pass us by. This is a description of the living God's response to the suffering of our world. He entered it. He took the suffering of the world upon himself because he took the sin of the world upon himself. God has faced the suffering and pain that we feel in the person of Jesus. And here's the key that I want no person to miss. Jesus didn't enter our suffering simply to empathize with our pain, though he does. But he entered it to take the cause of our suffering upon himself so that suffering would not have the final word in your life. Listen as Isaiah goes on, verse 5. "But he," Jesus, "he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed." The Christian story is one where God, in the person of Jesus, takes our sin upon himself and all the suffering that sin causes upon himself. And he bears these human wounds through the cross so that we ultimately can find healing in Jesus' name. Jesus takes the punishment upon himself so we might come to know peace with God, now in part, but in fullness when Jesus returns or when he calls us home. You see, the end to which Jesus leads us is what we call the resurrected life. Jesus, through his death and resurrection, is leading all who are willing to follow into a restoration of everything that has ever gone wrong in your life or our world. Which means that every horrible thing that has ever happened will one day be undone and repaired and will in some way make the joy we know in Christ even greater. This is our Christian hope of resurrection. This is God's solution to the problem of pain. He takes it on himself so that we are not destined to it, though we experience it. In his book, and I'll close with this, in his book, A Grace Revealed, Jerry Sitzer, he tells the tragic story of a great loss he experienced. He was driving his minivan one day when a drunk driver crossed the median and made a head-on collision, killing his wife, his daughter, and his mom. And he writes about how his surviving son, David, responded to the tragedy. This is what he says. He says, "My son David is, and always has been, quiet and reflective. After the accident, he was the least likely to talk about it. But when he chose to, he usually had something significant to say or ask. I had to be ready to respond to him when he sent cues indicating that he was ready to talk. Our best conversations happened in the car. One particular conversation has stayed fresh in my memory," Jerry writes. He says this, "David was 8 years old at the time. We were driving to a soccer match some distance from our home. And typically, for these occasions, David was quiet. The car was full of silence, not a heavy silence, but a liquid silence, as if some question was brewing inside him. 'Do you think Mom sees us right now?' he suddenly asked." And Jerry paused to ponder. "I don't know, David," he said. "I think maybe she does. Why do you ask?" "I don't see how she could see us, Dad. I thought heaven was full of happiness. How could she bear to see us so sad?" And Jerry then wondered, could Linda witness our pain in heaven? How could that be possible? How could she bear to see it? And then he responded, "I think she does see us, but she sees the whole story, including how it all turns out. Which is beautiful to her, David. It's going to be a good story, David." The Christian response to the problem of pain and suffering is found in the person of Jesus. Jesus feels our suffering. He has entered into our suffering. Jesus makes way for our ultimate rescue from suffering through the cross. And it is Jesus who leads us into the good story that we have yet to see. Let's pray. Jesus, I acknowledge in this moment that I have such a limited capacity to speak into pain. And Lord, where there are people here this morning who are feeling a measure of pain and they feel glossed over this morning, I pray that you would minister your Holy Spirit in a way that only you can. Because when we feel pain, talk of logic just falls short. But living God, breathe on these people. And if you're here this morning with pain, I invite you to, in some way, maybe you need to close your eyes, to picture bringing that pain to Jesus. You can trust him. He knows what it is. And he has what you need. And so Jesus, as your people, build us with the mind of Christ so that we can face the challenges that we face. And fill us with the Spirit of God so that all wisdom and truth and that all comfort that comes from your love would mark us. and make us whole. We love you, Jesus.